The ACN podcast is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners and sponsors, including the Agile Alliance. As a nonprofit membership organization, the Agile Alliance is an excellent resource to help you along your Agile journey. To learn more about the Agile Alliance and our other sponsors, as well as how you can become a sponsor or supporter of our show, please visit acnpodcast.org for more information. And thank you for your support. Okay, let's go ahead and get going. Good morning. This is the Agile Coaching Network. This is a virtual park bench, meaning that it's no holds bar. People can jump in at any time. Be though considerate though to the other people on the call. Basically, give enough time for people to jump into the conversation if they feel like they have something to add. If you look at this, we are saying no shameless promotion. So if you are from a consultancy, welcome. But we're not looking to go sell product. We're looking here to basically give advice to people who've been trying to do Agile adoptions. We like to hear both the good stories and the bad stories, meaning, you know, occasionally it's good to hear about something that was a great success. We vote up and vote down on a tool called Slido, which is in the link of the call. But you're welcome at any time to go add another question, or if you want to knock Jeremy off the top of the list with the first question here, you could do so at any time. With that, we're also recording this for a podcast. We're currently right now up on iTunes and also Google Play, as well as SoundCloud. All of those, please tell your friends about them if they can't make this call. The goal is to share it wide and share it big. So with that, let's go ahead and get going. Jeremy, you have the first question. Do you want to go ahead and give us some background on that?
Sure. So I joined a team about a year ago, and you know, the good team, great people, but it was clear that they were early on in their evolution. And one thing that I started helping with was improving the retro process. And in the beginning, the size of things that the team was taking on and their impact was pretty large. But as we dealt with those issues, the things that would get brought up and the experiments that people were trying just kind of got smaller and smaller. And, you know, it's a good team. They're making great progress, but they're not the best team in the world. So it felt a little bit like we'd hit a local maximum. And so I was trying to figure out how to sort of coach them and get them to a point where they're ready to take that next leap. In fact, that they knew that there was another hill to climb.
So I'll go ahead and dive in on this one. You're doing some retrospectives, right?
Yeah.
And is there still, you know, a list of certain things that are on there that the team hasn't been working on?
Most of the things that get brought up tend to be beyond their control, or they're little things.
Okay.
So again, they're not. I think they're just not thinking as big as they could be.
So, in the retrospective itself, if you look at maximum velocity, sometimes is dependency to me of just the number of people that are there. If you've got a well-performing team that's, you know, pretty much gotten to the point where they've reached that maximum. There's the only thing that you can really do is inject a new method, inject another person that kind of disrupts things. Also found that if you rotate Scrum Masters, if you are using Scrum or whoever the coach is, rotate the coach, that a new set of ideas come in as well. What do others think?
Well, one thing you could do is focus the team on the bigger picture, either organizationally larger and saying, look, we do well as a team, but how can we start to influence beyond the boundaries that we've traditionally looked at? Because as you said in your preface, there's probably places where others outside their direct sphere of influence are holding them back. So those are tougher nuts to crack, but they're still out there. And the other thing is, rather than focusing on can we make velocity yet another 10% faster, you could look at up-leveling their vision toward things like improving value delivery to stakeholders and focusing very clearly on value as opposed to the mechanics of Scrum or how agile are we today.
That's a good
I like the switch to focus on value.
Yeah.
And that's a good point, because I think sometimes we ignore that most of the time when we're coaching teams, at first it's mechanics, you know, and then moving on to value is probably a good thing.
It's sort of like some of Don Reinertsen's writings in Lean about scheduling to throughput and not to utilization. this is a slightly different take on that, but still, I think we work to value delivery and not maximum velocity. We really want to maximize value delivery.
Yeah, we're just starting to have some of those throughput conversations.
And just to understand a little bit, what would you frame up as value in your case?
You're asking, what would I frame up as value?
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious.
So I think there's a couple ways that the business needs to improve the definition of value, because we're still a lot of times taking requests from the business that don't necessarily have as clear value attached. So I'm looking at value as how much the, not the quantity of what can be delivered, but the effectiveness of it. So I think having those throughput versus utilization conversations, we're starting to have those. Are we managing the work well? The team is just starting to experiment with becoming more cross-functional because it's very siloed in their skill set. So the things that are, I think, impeding their ability to be as effective as they could be.
Right. The healthcare system in most countries is a really good example of this, where if you talk to people you know who are healthcare providers, they'll tell you that they work ridiculous hours, they come home exhausted every day, yet our experience as a patient in that system is not necessarily one of rapid, effective delivery of value. There's a lot of waiting. And it gets back to Reinertsen and scheduling utilization. So I think that the danger in always maximizing your velocity is that you get into that rut. It's like, yeah, we're all busting tail here, and we're exhausted at the end of every sprint, but are we really making a difference to the people that matter?
Hey, Dan, did you have something to add to this?
Yeah, my first thought, and Ray, you kind of hit on it a little bit, but was to inject some new ideas. So, you know, going to a conference or, you know, doing a Gemba walk of some other team and how they run retrospectives or different parts of their implementation would be a good way of, you know, perhaps injecting new ideas. But then just listening to Jeremy, I also was kind of wondering if there's enough, like, healthy tension in this system to get the team to improve.
Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by healthy tension?
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen it. Obviously, I don't know your team. But there's kind of this mentality that, you know, it's not just enough to come in every day and you know, write your tests or come in every day and develop whatever you're working on. But it's this idea that every time you come into work, you're expected to also improve the work while you're doing the work. So it's everyone's job to kind of continually improve the system that they're working in. And if you don't see that as part of your job, then that's part of the kind of healthy tension that you're missing. And it's not so much, you don't want to have so much tension in the system that, you know, you break people, right? Or you're on these death marches or whatever. There's kind of a delicate balance between, you know, having so much slack that everyone's comfortable they could deliver on time for everything versus there's just enough pressure to get a little bit better every, you know, sprint after sprint after sprint.
There's a maxim in the consulting industry that with times are really good and the economy is booming, it's good for consulting. And if times are really bad and the economy stinks, it's good for consulting because people feel the kind of threat, pain that Dan's talking about. It's those doldrums in the middle where nobody cares about getting any help. And I think if you take consulting out of the picture and you say, what about our internal service to ourselves as a team, much of the same applies. If the team is under great stress, then they're going to be very interested and motivated to improve. And if things are going at them so quickly that they can't keep up with it, they'll be motivated to improve. If you're in the doldrums in the middle, everybody's saying, go away.
We're good.
Nothing to see here.
Do you think that's the case, or do you think it's, you know, because I mean, I used to be in environments where everything was a fire drill, you know, and they made it a fire drill when it really didn't need to be. And so that, you know, when the team is, you know, in rest, you know, when I consider rest, meaning that, hey, this is just a general release and that's okay. I think there's some fear, but I think it's, I don't know, it's not honest to suddenly just make up a crisis on something just because you think that due date's...
You wouldn't necessarily want to make up a crisis, but you, certainly I think Edgar Schein and others in the culture world will say that the sort of improvement, the impetus to change, isn't going to be present in sufficient quantity unless there's some form of disconfirmation around the current environment.
Yeah.
But I think what needs to happen is that the team needs to set those goals, because, you know, there was a great quote that was done by Adam Savage from the Mythbusters. He was saying that if I don't give myself a deadline, I will get so creative and bring in all sorts of exotic materials and everything else into my work, and I'll never get done. So being able to sit down with the team and say that even just one meaningful goal of here's this, you know, small things, as you said, Jeremy, that they're working on, what small thing are we going to fix? And what's the deadline we want to set for having that done by, you know? And make sure that they're the ones that are making that commit versus that being all that, as you said, these things that are outside of the team. If you start applying, I think, more pressure from an outside urgency perspective, then they're going to still feel like they're out of control of the outside system. They have no control in that.
Hi, Ray, and hi, others. I think in the current world I'm in, I think, you know, we have lots of opportunities to improve our processes as well as, you know, while we are delivering some, you know, value-added work to the project. I see that, you know, sometimes from the management, that stick goes sometime, you know, okay, let's do some project improvement, and then when you put across some processes or some kind of framework and ideas, and it says, oh, no, we don't have time for this. We just look at the firefighting. So it's like, you know, going swinging from one side to the other. So then, you know, the situation is going to change. You are in the firefighting mode all the time. So that's the challenge, you know, sometimes I have. And, you know, you had to allocate some time or finding or giving some resources to improve these processes, or, you know, if we find any improvement, which, you know, eventually it'll going to help the help you out from the firefighting mode and then go in a regular way. The companies I worked before as well, it's that never occurred, you know, always trying to fix a firefighting, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and one thing to add, you know, so Jeremy, those outside problems that are there tends to be, do you think that there's not enough transparency to, you know, or, you know, to remove those roadblocks? You know, if suddenly the people either upstream or downstream from that's causing the team some stress, you know, is are those things out of bounds for the team to go off and just maybe even make presentations on, hey, this is why this impacts me?
I think that's an interesting idea. I think probably the team feels that these items are out of their control, and therefore not much that they can do about it, because they've raised issues in the past and haven't seen them get resolved. So I think there's a little bit of, hey, we tried that, it didn't work before, may not work this time. I think there's also some of the other topics that people brought up, I think, are also relevant, whether it's, you know, the lack of vision in terms of, not that they don't want to improve, they do, but, you know, Daniel, might have been you that said, get out to conferences. I think it helps to be able to see examples of what other people are doing, so, and to see how much better or how it could be better, and then you want to incorporate that into your own practice. And I think some of that awareness is lacking as well as even some of that kind of middle, the doldrums of the middle, that there's some pressure, but it's not extreme. There's more pressure in other parts of the business. Mm-hmm. But yet it's not flush, where, you know, they have a lot of resources to be experiment. So this sort of is this middle ground.
So one thing to be careful with conferences, and I've seen this multiple times in multiple teams, is, let's say, you know, at my previous company that I was with, they had this one riot, one ranger, meaning we send one person to the conference from a 10-person team. That person goes off and has a life-changing event, finds this really cool method that thinks it's going to go change the way that they go off and develop, and they come back and make a presentation, and the other nine people are sitting there pissed because they didn't get to go to the conference and can't even listen, you know. So thank you for having that mind-blowing event, but you know what? We had to stay here and work. So you got to be careful with the conference and events, you know, just from that aspect. I'm not sure if you've seen that before.
One thing, you know, because through the benefit of speaking is I get to go to a lot of events and I get to hear a lot of really smart people talk about interesting things. So one thing that was working pretty well is I would bring some of these ideas back and have some one-on-one conversations with someone else on the team who I knew was really open-minded to trying new things. Mm-hmm. And he was really, really well-respected on the team. So if I could introduce an idea to him, and if he got excited about it, he would introduce it to the rest of the team, and then they could get excited about it. Unfortunately, he moved on, so I'm trying to find his replacement. So somewhat helped address that issue, because I wasn't trying to sell it to the team. I was trying to sell it to one person who the team really respected.
Yeah, it's far better to have the idea come across the table, you know, from somebody else, as you said, someone with respect into the system, than to, you know, to just kind of speak to the wind sometimes. So are we ready to move on to the next question?
Yeah, thanks for everyone's input. This was great.
No problem. So, Tolasi, you have a question up here. Do you want to go ahead and give us some background on it?
Yeah, that was the last one, right? I can't even get to that link for some reason.
Oh, well, let me go ahead and read it to you. So, how do we manage the challenges of adopting Agile in organizations with legacy systems? There are new requirements that need context with the legacy system to coexist.
Right. Yeah, so one of my past experience where you have a train control system in place, and this whole code base or system is being tested again, and also has some certifications for having that code in place. And then now that is a legacy, you know, that's what been having, you know, been running the train for years and years. Mm-hmm. And now there's a new requirement has been added. Like for example, this is a Bombardier train manufacturer was the Bombardier, and actual control system was done by Alcatel. Now the company is called Thales in Canada. So the challenge was the Bombardier put a new requirement like if there is a power failure in the system, the system need to come back live within 5 minutes or so. So usually the standard standard story is when there is a power failure, all these automated trains brakes and brake to a safe limit and stops, and you know, let's say in the tunnel, for example, mm-hmm. and then somebody has to go to the particular train to restart these the CPUs. It take about an hour or so to come back. But the new requirement was, you know, one of the requirement is if during the power failure, the train has to recover automatically within 5 minutes, you know, when the power come back. Mm-hmm. So when you start to, you know, add these into the legacy system, we uncover a lot of the worms, can of worms, you know, it's just some functionality suddenly stop working. It's like, you know, facing unknown. You know, some of the legacy system were developed, the author is not around anymore. I mean, right. There's no documentation. And so this was a challenge. So one of the ways, I think, at the time I attempted to do and successfully, I mean, it was successful to some extent that you kind of treat the legacy system as a black box, and we stop touching that, and unraveling it, mm-hmm. instead of that, just get some services. You know, I mean, like turn that into a service-oriented thing. So let's say, you know, drive the train to 5 miles per hour, then you're just trying to get an API which is already in the legacy system to do that, not trying to integrate it with the new requirement. So, that was a solution we did. And I'm, you know, looking for the similar things, you know, whether the Agile will help, or anything in the Agile realm, can we do a better job at?
Sure. I mean, the first thing, and I'll share a story with you, because I had a team one time that was doing legacy-based systems, Fortran modules for banking as well as for aerospace. And the people who wrote it literally were retired. You know, they were just there was no one who knew how to maintain that code any longer. And this was an agile team that was stepping in. They were writing some higher level functions, kind of very similar situation. But we had to eventually get the strength to start to refactor those modules. And it became both an architectural, as you said, like breaking things off into finer APIs. And it became a huge retest effort in order to be able to ensure that we weren't, you know, sending a satellite, you know, the wrong direction. And so it was slower than we would have liked to do that refactoring. But by the time they got it done a year and a half, 2 years later, they had a much cleaner, maintainable code base that they can actually work with. And so technical practices wise, I think it's really stepping in and getting one layer down and really understanding that code was a big benefit. How about others?
Well, I would agree with that, because if you treat the legacy system as a black box, that can be effective in the short term. But Tulasi, in your example, you want the train to slow to 5 miles per hour, and you want the existing legacy system to provide that function. It doesn't necessarily mean that the time frame in which the legacy system could do that, or the reliability with which it could do that, is appropriate to the new situation. So you may not have the luxury of just treating it as a black box.
It's true, and yeah. I have constraint with that.
And moreover, I think that you end up with the air traffic control system. If we keep kicking the can down the road like that, just treating the system like a black box, it gets more and more obscure, more and more people retire and die who knew how it worked in the first place, and eventually the thing is going to have you over a barrel. So putting wrappers around things is a fine short-term solution, but to me it's a very interesting form of technical debt, something you're going to have to pay back reasonably quickly, or it's going to start to really accelerate on you and get out of control.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in my story, what happened was then, that project, you know, that because the, you know, timeline and all this pressure from the Bombardier, you know, the train builder, we kind of follow this approach, and then the next version, and then I think the management got the message, you know, this, as you said, it is a short-term, patching. So then they started the whole new way of looking at it, you know, okay, just rip up the pieces and then re-architect the whole thing, which can adapt or which can work with any new requirements coming into play. I agree.
Your question addressed the adoption of Agile around these systems, and I would still say, with a tie to the previous question, that if you take a value-driven approach to doing this, the iterative incremental learning-based approach to the system is going to be a winning approach in this case as well as in a pure Agile case. I mean, what's the alternative? You've got this block of legacy system out there, and your choices are to treat it like a black box and start some high interest rate technical debt running, or to take the sort of incremental iterative learning-based approach to addressing the issues in that system and taking the Agile approach. So why not? I mean, it's better than all the alternatives.
Yeah, I think
that's for sure.
The challenge comes in this, and again, especially in high systems with where fault tolerance is something that it can't be tolerated because we're dealing with human life. You're still going to need those extra steps. And I, you know, if you look at, if I create a work increment based out of, you know, some iteration, and I now, you know, either integrate it at the tail end of that iteration or sometime in between, I still need to take it to something that, you know, looks at all the pieces together. So it becomes critical, you know, whether or not it's in your DevOps section or someplace as an interface, as especially if you have multiple teams feeding it, you're going to still need to make sure you make the investment that system one matches system two. I would typically, when I do those type of refactoring, I'm looking to compare systems without making a huge delta in features. I want to have comparable features, meaning I want to test the 5-mile braking system, you know, of the old code to the 5-mile braking system of the new code. And I don't want to have five other new features that are stacked on top of that. I just want to make sure that that legacy is still legacy. And, you know, within your architectural guidelines, making sure that people understand that there are certain classes of code that require that, you know, you're going to have your, you know, paired programming get multiple eyeballs on it to making sure that it does equal the old code. And you're going to have multiple levels of check that are put in there just to ensure that you're not, you know, causing any problems down the road. And that's something similar to what Boeing does in their flight control systems that they use Scrum in. Dan, do you have something to offer to this?
Yeah, I don't have much direct experience with this, Talasi, but you know, one book or one author I did come across at a prior conference is based out of Seattle's David Bernstein. He's got a pretty good book on Beyond Legacy Code, and I pasted the link in the chat, so that might be another source of ideas for you.
Okay, right.
And that's actually a pretty good book. I've gotten some good reviews back on that.
What's the author again, Dan? What's again? Sorry, can you type it in or?
I typed it in the chat, but his name is David Bernstein, and the book is Beyond Legacy Code.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Okay, thanks.
Okay, are we ready to pivot? I guess that's a yes. So the next question is, we have, is Agile just a means to an end or something more? Is it a goal, but is it simply just a tool? And I know that the person who wrote this question is not here today. So I think we have to unpack that.
Well, yeah, I think we could start by going back to say, where did Agile come from? Mommy, Daddy, where does Agile come from? Yeah.
Yeah, not this question.
And if you look at it, it wasn't some random event or a lightning strike that was unexpected. Agile emerged as a response to an environment. It didn't come out of nowhere. It was a nearly logical, at least in retrospect, thing to happen given what was going on. So to me, absolutely, it is a means to a greater end. And okay, one more time, I'll beat the value drum, because if you look at the very first Agile principle, it says that's the main principle of Agile, is stakeholder value delivery. So this came out of an environment of complexity as a response, mainly in software, because they sensed it before the rest of the world did. And yeah, it's a means to a greater end. It's not a goal, and it certainly isn't just the technical practices or the named methodologies or anything else.
Well, and to add to that, anytime someone inserts the word tool and agile together, that, you know, makes my feathers on the back of my head go up. And that's Agile by itself, if you look at the manifesto and its principles, those are giving us values and heuristics that should be used by the development team, the customers, management, and others in order to be able to use certain tools in a more effective way. You know, it's really the operating system behind, you know, the hand that's, you know, working with the code. It's, you know,
as we've said in our training for years, Agile is a culture and a mindset. It's not a tool or a method.
So with that, I mean, if you look at the other part of the question itself is, you know, if you look at means to an end, you know, if you look at, you know, the delivery of any system, you know, you should never do an agile adoption because you just want to do an agile adoption. You're addressing something in the business that the business needs. They need faster, you know, they want to create higher value for their customer. They need to have, you know, a better, more efficient way of delivering something that's, you know, continuous improvement, you know, so on and so forth. And so, you know, the first part of this question is, to me, you know, you should never pick that and say that, oh, it's just going to be all about Agile. You still have to have those other goals that are in the background, or the primary goals in the background.
This is a perennial problem. You remind me of one of the funniest t-shirts I've ever seen back in the mid-80s when the CMM was holding sway. I saw somebody at a conference who had a t-shirt on that said on the front, "My company adopted CMM and all I got was this stupid t-shirt." as a riff on the "my parents went to Hawaii and all I got was a stupid t-shirt" kind of souvenir, joke souvenir. So yeah, if all you're doing is adopting Agile as a corporation to give everybody a t-shirt, what's the point?
That makes me kind of mad because I never got my CMMI t-shirt.
No, this is a CMM t-shirt. I don't know what the CMM may be about.
But. Oh, okay.
I think the point's well taken, that there can be sort of vacuous adoption in any discipline. The CMM had its benefits, it had its problems, but the sort of vacuous adoption can happen anywhere in any kind of methodology if you're not careful.
Do you think part of that was because of the novelty? Because, I mean, we all saw how CMMI, you know, and CMM, you know, how they lost fad. Do you think that some of this stuff, when you talk about the means to the end, could also be the fact that in certain cases people consider I'm agile because I need to be agile, or I need to be CMM because,
well,
I'm CMM?
Back about the same time, I remember Carl Wiegers about the same time was doing a talk that said, this was back in the Bush era of Read My Lips, No New Taxes, and Carl riffed on that in a wonderful talk called Read My Lips, No New Models. And his point was, we don't need any new models, we just need to effectively apply what we already have. And there is this sort of great hope that the next big thing is going to fix it all with a simple solution. And it just never works.
I agree with that. I mean, I got into a conversation with a few people last week and I tweeted out, you know, my frustration with this Beyond Agile conversation that, you know, always comes up, you know, well, the next version of Agile or beyond what we're doing in Agile and all this. It's just like, well, you know, when does delivering value go out of fad? You know,
right.
Ever. It doesn't.
The goal, the goals are going to be more durable and they're going to be less prone to changing every few years to a decade. But it's like one of my old bosses used to say, said there's always three tools in your life. The one you just shit canned, the one you're currently dissatisfied with, and the one you're lusting after. And if we're not careful, the same thing's true with methodologies, you know? We shit can one methodology, we're currently dissatisfied with one, and then there's this one on the horizon that looks like, oh, that's the one, finally, that's going to fix everything.
To add a slightly different riff on that, I think that tools have the life expectancy of a good dog, you know? And they last for about 7 years, you know? And then you get a new dog, you know? It's, I know that's kind of, mine's a little darker, but... It's kind of in the same. Does anyone else have stuff to add to this? Jeremy?
I was at a table listening to some very smart people at the last Agile Alliance conference, and one of the topics that came up that was sort of an interesting one to posit, but, you know, never really came to a conclusion, was, is the success of these techniques due to the fact that early adopters are highly motivated people to, you know, who want to get shit done and make things effective? And then when you kind of bring those to a sort of an average audience that doesn't have that same motivation, they fail. So how much of it is due to the temperament of these early adopters and innovators versus the techniques themselves?
That's an excellent point.
That is. I mean, some people, I mean, are just really good at, you know, I'm still kind of scratching my head on the Beyond Estimates group and, you know, some of the other different kind of fringes that are out there. But some of them have some really, really good spokespeople for their stuff, you know.
Steve McConnell has been a sort of vocal spokesperson for this phenomenon, saying that, you know, the differences between individual performance swamp the differences between different methods performances. And he shares the anecdote and talks frequently about how the team that created XP was so talented that they would have succeeded almost in spite of themselves. The process really didn't matter because these people were phenomenal. So that goes to your point, Jeremy, about if you put the right people in a room, they're going to win. They're just fantastic performers.
It kind of raises a question then, is how do you create that kind of motivation more broadly, so that others who may not be natural, who may not have that drive as a natural tendency, start to move in that direction?
Well, I think part of it is you know, the things around practitionership, you know, and the ability for us to really strive to be, you know, the best on our game or the best that we can be. I tweeted out this picture from the this video from the Beautiful Mind, you know, movie, and it was the scene at the end where people walked up and they handed, you know, each of the professors handed this one gentleman a pin and set it on the table. You know, it's the ultimate respect for the person's skill, you know, and that recognition is something that people were wanting. They wanted that to be the top of their game, you know. And I think that's a, you know, as Eric was saying about the XP people, I mean, I think that was the people we surrounded ourselves with, right? You know?
Yeah, whenever I interview somebody for a position in my career, the second to last question I've asked them always is, what have you done in the last 3 months to improve your skills? And if they couldn't answer, that was a bad sign. The last question was always, what do you do for fun? And if it's the answer was more work, that was also a problem. But that previous question, you know, what have you done in the last 3 months to improve your skills? Things like, I listen to the ACN, or I go to conferences, I read books, whatever it is, tell me. But if you can't come up with anything that you've done to be a better professional in 3 months, I'm a little worried.
That's a good point.
But it was frequently the case. People, it would just catch them, stop them in their tracks, and they'd realize, I haven't done anything in memory to be better at what I do.
That wouldn't be my response. I'd ask it. Apparently I'm not getting the job, right, Eric?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, yeah, wouldn't you just make up something? You know, I'm doing, you know.
Well, they can try. Which, that reminds me of the best answer my brother ever got doing an Agile interview. He asked somebody about some new Agile technique, and this person was familiar with it, and he said the answer was yes. No. Okay, what is it? So this person had just no clue what it was, tried to lie and then caught himself, said no, and then realized, I don't even know what that is.
So are we ready to move to the next question? I think that's a yes.
Hey, Joe. I'm anonymous. Can you guys jump up to my question?
Sure, Joe. I have no problem. All agree, let's go vote up Joe. Joe, done. So, Joe, why don't you give us some background on your question?
Okay, I'm going to be starting as a Scrum Master in the public sector here in California, state of California. All my background is in the private sector, where teams are motivated by revenue. Is there anybody have any background or words of wisdom on how to motivate a team in the public sector, and, you know, what to watch out for?
Yes, I spent 5 years in the public sector before I went into the private sector with the state of Oregon. And one of the attendees at the Constructs Executive Summit every year is from East Bay Mud, which is the Metropolitan Utility District, the water people. So it's a great name, East Bay Mud. The major difference is you're going to run into a unionized environment where pay is not, as you point out, the attractor for performance that it would be otherwise. Job security is generally there, and if you bust tail and do something spectacular, you get a merit increase just like the person next to you that wasted time most of the year. So you have to distinguish these folks by things like the freedom to choose their assignments, public recognition if the person likes that sort of thing, doling out budget to go to conferences, which is limited, and other ways, the intrinsic motivations other than money, because that won't do it. And you can't even really threaten folks in a unionized environment like you could with, you're going to lose your jobs. Like, oh yeah, that'll take you 2 years. And by then you'll be gone and I'll still be here.
Well, hey, Eric, when you were in that role, how much exposure did the people you worked with have to the citizens they were helping?
It varies, but it could be next to none. Now, in my case with the health division, we had good interaction with our stakeholders that were trauma hospitals, and we also worked next to the epidemiologists who were off doing infectious disease, food poisonings, various outbreaks. So we had a lot of outreach. But a lot of the folks who were working in a Department of Revenue or something like that, or in various other administrative agencies, have great separation from the actual people they serve.
Well, you know, the city of San Jose, I think, has been doing, I think, annually this hackathon that they do, where they get both private as well as public employees get together and they work on something that the city needs. And they do it in a way where they're, I believe, bringing in, you know, college students and others as well, that sort of gives it, you know, that intrinsic motivator of, you know, hey, there's this problem that we have in the community. They have some community members that are representing those problems, and they just go off and they fix those things, and they get some tremendous results based upon that.
I also found a bit more compartmentalization in the public sector, where if your job title is a research analyst, as mine was, you start to raise eyebrows, hackles, and a few other concerns if you start doing things like writing code just because there's a problem that needs solving. So watch out for sort of pigeonhole syndrome, where people either won't feel empowered or they'll be actively discouraged from solving problems creatively just because that's not your job description.
Well, some of the learned helplessness that occurs, though, when you have very rigid systems, you know, and I'm not sure, Joe, if that's the environment you're coming from. It's very, you're going rigid to more of an agile type of environment. That's a paradigm shift for a lot of people, and they've got to get comfortable with owning portions of their job that they before really didn't own. And so, you know, easing into changing, you know, and we looked at this as something called policy buffers, where we have the standard governance system that says that this is what I do in my job and here's my job description and all that. But what is the policy if you were to have to step outside of that role? What does that look like? And so when you do things like collaborative chartering and other things where people are able to first represent what they do, but then you can throw out situations to say, well, what if this situation occurs? This is currently out of the governance. It's basically violating a policy, even particularly. What would be our operating procedure if we were on the other side? And, you know, giving people with more flexible boundaries that says that, yes, you can be over there, but you can only be over there for a couple days or whatever it might be before you inform somebody that you're having to go do that. That tends to open the system up a little bit further for people to understand that they have a little bit more flexibility in what they do in their job. And it does take a while to get comfortable with that, you know.
We also found that if you start getting positive results, and if you're in a position where your stakeholders are in touch with you, and they start sending people like the administrator of your division wonderful notes, that when someone who is concerned about your flexibility or your initiative starts complaining, that there were several times that we ended up in the administrator's office and the administrator saw the train we were on and said, I'm not going to stop that train. You guys adapt to what they're doing.
Right.
So if you've got results that you can bring to the table and say, I'm not just doing this because I feel like being a pain in the ass, I'm doing this because this is the best way to serve my constituency, and look at the results we're getting, then you can probably get people on board to say, okay, let's adapt the model to this rather than just forcing the old way.
Fully agree with that. And I think one of the things that you know, you might be able to try too, and I'm not sure who this organization reports into, but looking at, you know, most government positions have some sort of civilian oversight, you know, making the team connect to the civilian oversight to be able to give their demos. You know, hey, we're working on these things. What's your input? So create sort of a sub-advisory board or some sort that can actually receive the product and look at it and give reviews. And that type of intrinsic motivator of getting feedback from, heck, the mayor or a city council person to anyone else who's in that role, that they're trying to go add value by their own position, that actually it tends to be helpful as well. And it gives that intrinsic motivator that someone cares about what I'm delivering about as well. Tulasi, do you have anything to add, or Ruth, or others? I'll take the long pauses. No. Joe, did that help?
It did. You know, I from what I understand, I'm waiting for all my paperwork to get cleared and my background check to be done. I should be checking in today or tomorrow. But it looks like they have a great feedback mechanism. They're really trying to promote the Agile. They're very transparent. Everything is up on, you can Google it and look at the backlogs and so forth. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting project.
Cool.
I'm just concerned, you know, working, like you said, with the unionized workforce, you know, overstepping, you know, powers and all that political stuff that you have to be concerned with, you know.
Yeah. This, with my service, was 20 years ago now, and some 25 years ago. The two things I still remember from a reward perspective, I don't remember the paycheck. It was minuscule. I don't remember any of that kind of unionized stuff. I remember being appointed to the clinical faculty of Oregon Health Sciences University, and I remember getting a plaque from the governor of Oregon. Those mm-hmm. were completely non-compensatory rewards, right. But they were the things that drove me on. Because it certainly wasn't a paycheck. Nobody works there for the paycheck.
Right. Yeah, working for the pension.
Okay.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Hey,
Joe, I have one other thought. I missed the first part of your question. I had to reboot my system. But there are, you know, parts of the federal government and state governments that are already doing, you know, agile adoptions, lean startup adoptions. So there's already quite a bit of work out there in terms of talks and papers and whatnot. A couple that come to mind are the city of Hayward in California, and then there's a whole government agency in the GSA called 18F that does quite a bit of agile and lean startup consulting. The GSA is the General Services Administration.
Mm-hmm.
So, if those help.
Also, some people are delivering to the public, like the Fannie Mae and others are also in that space as well. And I know that some of those people do, in fact, get out to conferences and share. The last Agile conference last year that I went to, there was a number of different people from government that were there. So with that, we have probably time for one more question. And it looks like if I were to go down onto the list, let's see, how effectively deal with impediments caused by support functions? And the person who put this on here, I know, is not here, but I think from support functions would be finance? Would it be, teams providing infrastructure to tools that are probably not working in Agile? What would be the best way to deal with those types of impediments?
This kind of ties together a lot of what we've been talking about. It's a bit of Jeremy's question on how do we make improvements across these boundaries, because you're going to have an HR, IT, or finance organization or other support function that is not necessarily Agile, so you've got to work across those boundaries. And it's also about how to motivate change. So there's a lot going on here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting to say that a support function becomes an impediment to a team.
A missed opportunity. You know, we could be a little more gracious than that.
Well, I mean, I've had the situation where, you know, my primary software team goes off and implements in an Agile way. And then we had the distribution team or the team that was responsible for, say, some of the automation infrastructure that weren't. And, you know, that alignment becomes a bit of a concern. And you remember, Eric, with the PLC, the product lifecycle that we used to work under, that sometimes created some impediments as well because of the lack of synchronization.
Right. Well, I guess in general, you probably have to address each of the support organizations a little differently, because back to Joe's point, when you get into things like HR, you get a more regulated legal environment where you've got to be very careful about how you treat people. HR has limits to what they can and can't do, written into the law. Finance has their own set of limitations because there are GAAP principles for accounting, and there's the federal regulations around financing. That said, within those limitations, there's got to be ways that we could use Agile to be more Agile and use an incremental, iterative, learning-based approach to improve budgeting, let's say. I remember, Dan, you and I used to work on trying to get people away from an annual budget cycle and stepping to a quarterly budget cycle, or putting a reserve in place for that wonderful project that comes up on June 12th so that there's a way to fund it, rather than saying, well, that's a great idea, but we'll have to wait till next year. So I think it depends on the nature of the support function as to how to engage, but generically it's got to be using Agile to be more Agile, and it's not going to be some big bang or some waterfall thing. It's going to be very delicate, tactical engagement on a continuous basis.
Well, I think it does come down to the modifications done around a cadence. I mean, I considered that when we were doing a sprint, that was about $40,000. It was an investment. It was an incremental investment of 10 people's worth of time for 2 weeks. And treating it like an investment, I think, changes the dynamics of, are we going to get that $40,000 back? You know, are we just throwing that because we just want to be busy? You know, so I think there's a higher level system. If you think of support functions, if, you know, they need to be in service of that team. They're not in service for their own delivery. You know, it's sort of like when IT departments go off and they say, well, you're going to have to go use this one, but you say it doesn't support your need, and they treat you like you're the customer.
This is more like Jeremy's question around local maximum again, because if you have support functions that are trying to save 10%, in our experience, we recall in our old company the rollout of a training system that saved the group that does training a few million dollars a year. But what it cost the entire 100,000 person company in terms of frustration and lost productivity was far more than that. So the local optimization issue is here too. So maybe you get around some of these problems by fracturing the silos and embedding more of these support functions as primary members of the teams that they're on.
I mean, does it become a goal problem though? I mean, if I have my own set of goals and that support team has their own set of goals, versus is there a common set of goals that we should both be working off of?
I mean, there are, but you still have to balance them.
Yeah, the way I don't know, my lean background's starting to come up here, but in lean, you know, we talk a lot about value streams and what are the primary value streams of the business, and these support organizations need to support those value streams. So every time, like Eric said, when a training organization comes out with some new system, you know, it needs to take into account what's the impact on the value stream from that change, right? And that's one way you shift the thinking to system level optimization, as opposed to, you know, this is a good idea for the silo.
Sure.
Is by focusing on the impact of the value stream.
Well, we recall times when you could save a dime on a chipset, but it cost an original equipment manufacturer $1.10 to put out a laptop on that. So it was a false economy for sure. So Dan, you're right. It's a big picture value stream is a good one.
So with that, guys, we are at the top of the hour. I'd like to thank everyone for actually pulling this in one day because of the fact that we've got the Agile Open Northwest starting tomorrow. Again, tell everyone the podcast is available. We're getting lots of replays. A lot of new people are discovering it. It's a good way to amplify this across your organizations. If you can't make the time, of course, put your questions in Slido. And with that, you know, spend the next couple of weeks doing some great stuff and come back to us and tell us what cool new Agile thing that you're doing.